What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Real Bodybuilding Podcast, and this is episode 101, and I am here with Mr. Stan Efferding. How are you, sir?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good, man. I see you doing a lot of big things lately. How's everything going?
It's going good, man. I'm doing what I love. Yeah. You know, after retiring from bodybuilding and powerlifting, I had to kind of reinvent myself, and coaching seems to be my passion, so I'm loving it.
I think that's what we all can hope. You know, when I started bodybuilding, I was like, as long as I end up doing something good after bodybuilding, then I'll know it was all worth it. So I think the fact that you found something that you're passionate about after your career is over is amazing.
Yeah.
So you're doing, the reason I want to get you on, I guess we'll just get right into it. You're coaching the heavyweight, well, not the heavyweight, the light heavyweight champion of the world, John Jones in the UFC, who has out, I know some of you guys are fight fans, so I know he's relinquished his title, but he's still the champ, as far as I'm concerned. So what is that like, Stan?
Wow, it's a lot of work. I'll tell you what. Originally, just got invited down to discuss diet. And then we, you know, we talked about his nutrition program and we trained together and had a good discussion. And at the end of the day, you know, a lot of my experience, people who know my story know that I've run a number of very successful companies. My telecommunications company had over 100 employees in 20 states. My real estate development firm, we bought, built, and sold over $60 million in real estate. We built multifamily, single family subdivisions. So a lot of what I did was project management, you know, and management. And that was kind of a missing piece in John's camp, is he didn't really have everything coordinated. He had a lot of great talent with his different coaches, but didn't really have a plan or a schedule in place. And of course, there isn't even a fight set, but he knew he needed to get started working towards getting himself back into fight shape. And so we sat down and we orchestrated a plan, created a schedule, and then got together with all of his coaches and tried to design something that worked for everybody, but also was most beneficial for John, meaning that, you know, we managed his fatigue and his physical capital. Yeah. Which becomes important because, you know, everybody thinks that what they do is you know, of primary importance for John's success, and they end up sometimes overtaxing him as a result. So it was a bit surreal to go to Jackson Wink and to sit down with, you know, Greg Jackson and Winkle John and his other coaches, Brandon and, you know, Tusa, his jiu-jitsu coach, and his strength and conditioning coaches, Steve and Jordan. You know, we all got together and just sat down with a blank piece of paper and said, you know, first John described what he thought he needed.
Sorry, Stan, can I interrupt you for 1 second? I just want to ask, how did the original call come about? Like, did you send them a message at all, or did somebody just call you out of the blue?
No, actually, John's strength and conditioning coach, Jordan, from Zia Strength down here, Jordan Chavez, he reached out to Mark Bell for help with John's nutrition. It was kind of a missing piece of the puzzle. Mm. And Mark Bell put him in touch with me.
Okay.
And okay. So really that's how the introduction came about. And then, you know, John was interested in listening to what I had to say. So I flew down and met with him and talked with him about his nutrition program. And that's kind of how it all kicked off. And just from there, you know, as mentioned, we just decided that it was much more comprehensive than that. Cause you know, when I discuss the vertical diet, it's always about sleep, hydration, nutrition, compliance, digestion. So, you know, I started talking about all those pieces of the puzzle and I think that they just realized they wanted a more comprehensive involvement. And so that's kind of what I'm doing, is just kind of helping coordinate all of these great talents that he has in his camp.
The strange part to me is, I thought, and this could be my own misconception, but I thought fighters were turned off by bodybuilders. And I know you're a lot more than a bodybuilder, so I don't want to just frame you that way.
But I get it.
I thought when they saw you, they would be like, oh, it's just another bodybuilder, you know, forget it.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And certainly, you know, my resume, a lot of people don't understand that, you know, I came out of the University of Oregon in exercise science and was a high school soccer coach. Yeah. And worked training track athletes at the University of Oregon, sprinters and distance runners. And then spent many years working with their football players at the University of Oregon football team. So my experience is rooted in sports in general, and worked with fighters and worked with wrestlers and, you know, obviously CrossFit national champions now, strongmen, of course, you're familiar with all the people I've worked with. So yeah, that's my passion. That was my pursuit, bodybuilding and powerlifting. But, you know, my experience is in sports performance and, you know, both in training and nutrition for those folks. So I think it lent itself very well. And a lot of people are concerned that John's gaining weight and that he doesn't want to put on too much muscle because it, you know, has a high demand for oxygen and energy and water, et cetera. And, you know, it's certainly well understood. And we've designed a program that is focused on fighting. We're looking on, you know, all the aspects that go into that. So it's not about hypertrophy specifically. It's not about strength specifically. It's about speed strength, about speed endurance. You know, it's about the kinds of tools that you'll need to be a better fighter at the heavyweight level.
Yeah. When you walk into Jackson Wink, are you intimidated at all? Or do you know that they need you more, not more than you need them, but do you know that you fit there, that you're needed and your skill set is needed? Or is there kind of an intimidation that you're, you know, you're at the champs camp, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's certainly an enormous level of respect for those folks, what they've accomplished with John and with so many great fighters. It's, you know, obviously one of the best camps in the world.
Yeah.
But there were some missing pieces, and I did feel as though I had, you know, a great deal of experience and could contribute. And it was, you know, we sat down and we got together and, you know, it's an orchestra, it's a collaboration.
Yeah,
it wasn't about telling anybody what they needed to do. It was about providing them the resources that they needed so they could get what they needed done. And more so than anything, just a schedule. And, you know, the conversation really always kicks off with the fact that your athlete has limited physical capital.
Yeah.
And you need to invest that wisely. And yes, he needs to do grappling. And yes, he needs to do striking. And yes, he needs to do strength and conditioning. But if any of those is too taxing on him, it can draw from the other. If he can't recover, you know, obviously we work on expanding his physical capital in recovery with, by improving his sleep and hydration and nutrition. But at the same time, we got to be cautious with fatigue. Yeah. And so when we designed the schedule, we designed it mostly in part to see what are his hard days and do we follow them with basically what we'd call a recovery day? What skill work and what is, you know, for strength and actually physically demanding. So we could stack his fatigue. We usually like to stack fatigue on the same day so the subsequent day can be a little lighter for recovery from and preparation for the next hard day. So that's what we did.
The, I think the common thought process, I think, of at least from my end, was that you were going in there just to do his strength and conditioning. But it seems like you're going in there, like, as you said, to coordinate everything. So you have a much larger role than I thought originally. Like, you're not just doing, hey, this is how I'm going to teach you how to lift heavy weights. You're doing a lot more than that there, aren't you?
Yeah. And, you know, he has great coaches. He has a great strength coach. He's a great conditioning coach. Okay. You know, obviously he's got great striking coaches and great jiu-jitsu coach, some of the best in the world. And he's thrived under their, you know, their instruction. He's gotten strong and he's, obviously extremely well, extremely talented. But historically in talking to him about what, you know, his experience was historically, they would grind him pretty hard. Everybody wanted to train him as hard as possible every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he would experience some fatigue. We see a lot with fighters is they end up losing a significant amount of lean mass and strength as a result of those, all that hard training.
Yeah.
And they have a higher exposure to injury. A lot of those folks end up getting hurt, you know, right before the fight.
Sure.
And just fatigue in general, you know, it's going to lower testosterone, lower thyroid, increase cortisol, raise your resting heart rate, you know, which will adversely affect your sleep. And so over time, I think these people will just get more and more tired. An interesting statistic in the UFC, fighters who drop out for whatever reason, injured or what have you, and are replaced with a last minute fighter, the last minute fighters have a winning percentage.
Oh, wow. Cause they're healthy and rested.
They're healthy.
Yeah.
And that's really the primary goal, is to do no harm, to bring your athlete in healthy.
Yeah.
And I've seen it many, many times in history with fighters, you know, from the sidelines. And I've worked with professional fighters as well, just not at the UFC level.
Yeah.
And they do overtrain, they get weaker, they get injured. They'll even fight injured, you know, disguise the injury. We know that. They'll always talk about it after the fact.
Yeah.
Broken hand, broken, you know, bone in their foot, you know, whatever, pulled muscles. Happens very commonly. So that was the big focus, was just to get everybody to coordinate their efforts and make sure that that we could get some measurements implemented so that John's strength and speed weren't compromised as a result of the intensity of the training.
As you said, you've trained a lot of fighters, maybe not the UFC level, but you've trained a lot of professional fighters. So are they up to speed on training and nutrition and all of the different facets that bodybuilders, because I always feel like bodybuilders are kind of the guinea pigs for the rest of the world. We kind of figure things out first and it trickles down to everybody else. Is that the case with fighting, or do they have things figured out there?
It's even worse than fighting, because these folks, generally speaking, don't have the funds to be able to afford a quality trainer or a nutritionist.
Okay.
And so I used to think that fighters, even at a high level, you know, I even thought that of some of the great athletes that I've worked with, had all that figured out. And as you go in and start to ask questions, you discover that some people they're successful in spite of themselves. and, you know, working with college athletes, you find out that you know, they're genetically gifted in many cases. Their nutrition usually sucks. They eat fast food a lot. And they can get away with it in their 20s, in their early 20s.
I don't know how much you're allowed to divulge, but is that something that John Jones was doing? Like, is he just that talented that he kind of was getting by without doing all the maybe best things for himself?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think, and John even himself would acknowledge that his, and he's said it many times publicly on interviews, et cetera, with Joe Rogan, that his sleep and his discipline outside the gym wasn't where it could have been or should have been.
Yeah.
And he was successful because he is very talented and he is very hardworking. I find that about most athletes, is they will train hard. They'll go to the gym and bust their ass. But you know, one of the first things I said is that you don't grow in the gym. I've always said that. I wrote that article 10 years ago for NPC, and you don't grow in the gym. And, you know, you grow eating and sleeping, as we know, in the recovery phase. You're also concerned with those other things I discussed about, you know, injury potential and just declining over the course of the camp. So, no, my experience is that fighters have, do not have good advice, can't afford it. You look at the payouts, even at the UFC from some of those fights, and it's really pathetic. They cannot afford, you know, good information, good advice. It's out there, but, you know, they're focused on fighting. Yeah. And even the mentality inside the camp. One of the more difficult messages that I had to kind of try and deliver or discuss or negotiate, fight coaches believe that you fight to get in shape. I believe you get in shape to fight.
I see.
And for the reasons I mentioned, when you fight to get in shape, I think that you decline, you know, you lose muscle, you're exposed to greater injury potential. I just think that even mentally, for a 3-month camp, or this will probably be at least a 4-month camp, we have to be very cautious that we keep him engaged and interested mentally, because these camps can be a long grind if you're just constantly beating up on somebody. So I use the analogy. I said, we're building mountains. We're not digging ditches.
Yeah, maybe.
And a lot of people, they want to get you in there and they just want to just beat you up. And that's digging ditches. And you might not actually get your recovery from that. You know, you need that super compensation. And it's just a process of overtraining. And so we're trying to, you know, to do it a little differently and keep him healthy and active and interested throughout the camp.
I want to get into this a little bit later, but just really quickly, it seems like your philosophy on physique and building muscle is almost solely based on recovery and staying fresh. Is that why you look the way you look at 50? Like, is this one of your main components of your program?
Yeah, that I think generally speaking, the reason I was able to survive as long as I did in powerlifting was because I didn't do it all the time. I did a lot of bodybuilding in between. So I lightened the loads. I did more volume, sets and reps, shorter rest periods. I built up a great cardiovascular base from that. You know, those 90-second rests with you know, lots of volume, you're destined to build up a lot of cardiovascular base. Plus, I was well balanced. I did a lot of, you know, as we do in bodybuilding, we do every body part from every angle.
Yeah.
Fighters tend not to do that. Do a lot of striking, not nearly enough back work to compensate for all of that, you know, anterior work. They don't do enough posterior chain, or at least not effectively, you know, working, you know, hamstrings, glutes, and back.
Yeah.
And so we're, you know, we focus on those things. We find weaknesses. And then even after I stopped competing in powerlifting, you know, every now and then I'd still try and go in and do some of the things that I used to do that as you age, you know, I set my world record when I was 45 years old.
Yeah.
And that was an all-time world record at any age. And it, of course, still hasn't been beaten. Nobody over 40 is total.
Got a call coming in.
Let me get you back there. Yeah. Nobody over 40 is ever totaled 2303. That was my three lift total. But at the time I did it, I was 45 years old, and it was an all-time world record at any age group. So, you know, it has a lot to speak about longevity. And now that I'm, you know, 53 years old, I employ a lot of the same methods, you know, using relatively shorter rest periods, less, you know, really heavy lumbar loading with any significant frequency. You know, occasionally you'll see me do a heavy squat, but it's rare. It's not all the time.
Yeah.
And I focus more on, you know, muscles than movements. You know, with fighters, of course, I don't want to focus on muscles. I want to focus on movement patterns and sport specific stuff, but I can do that without over fatiguing them. You know, and not training heavy all the time. You know, of course, the focus there is going to be for speed, strength, and speed endurance. And so we do a lot of stuff that's specific for that.
Going back to John's diet, are you doing his nutrition, or does he have a nutritionist that you're guiding?
No, I do his nutrition.
Okay.
It's the vertical diet. It's not unfamiliar. It's the same exact stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I replaced chicken with lean red meat. I used more easy to digest foods so he doesn't have the gas and bloating.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things that he was experiencing. He was having trouble with, as been my experience with most of my clients.
Yeah.
So I kind of lead with that low FODMAP diet, with a few variations. You know, the foundation is micronutrient dense, easy to digest foods. I made sure that he got 1,000 milligrams of calcium from dairy daily. So we've implemented yogurt and he seems to tolerate it very well. We use fruit, of course, and where we need to drive calories beyond, you know, those micronutrient dense fruits and vegetables, we're using white rice as the primary fuel for carbohydrates you know, help him maintain his workload and his weight. So his body composition is already improved. His digestion, he feels, is much better. His compliance is really what was most important to me. So got together with his wife, and she's taking daily pictures of every meal, sending me his body weight and hours of sleep. So we're working on just the foundation, the fundamentals, the things that historically, you know, by his own admission, he didn't concentrate as much on. And his changes just in the last less than 4 weeks have been extraordinary. They really have.
So when you start with a client, I know you get an entire history of what they're doing and all that. Did you get anything from John? Did you find out like what he was eating, and was it way off base, or what was it like?
I did not get a history on John because we just hit the ground running. I just came down and visited him and then immediately sent the diet to his wife. And so, but by his own admission, he would eat out when it was convenient. He would eat what he enjoyed. He did gain mass. He did gain strength. I think his body fat percentage was a little higher than I would have wanted. But he's already made significant changes in that. He's already brought his body fat percentage down and increased his lean mass. So, you know, we're real pleased with how fast he transforms. Mm-hmm. Plus his speed, His endurance has substantially improved. I think a lot of that is going to be as a result of those those foundational principles. You know, he's just sleeping more, eating better, you know, at least four times a day with the protein feeding. So he's recovering faster. And then he's, you know, he's even implemented some naps here and there, the 10-minute walks after meals. Yeah. He kind of really enjoys the structure and how he feels. Just keep him moving a lot. And we're doing two a day. So he'll do AM, PM workouts 6 days straight. But they're not always challenging. As I mentioned, we'll stack, you know, high fatigue days with low fatigue days.
So he isn't having any trouble going from kind of a relaxed lifestyle to this extremely strict, very regimented life.
No, he actually likes it. And I find that to be the case. Once you've got a plan in place and you've got a goal and structure, that it really helps you focus. Obviously he still doesn't have a fight, but his mindset is that he will, mm-hmm. And he's just going to act as if he's going to, you know, to continue to train as though there's, you know, something on the horizon, whether that be 4 months or 6 months. At this point, we're not too concerned. He just wants to be the best John Jones he's ever been. And that's, you know, that's frightening to think of it, you know, 240 plus pounds by the time he's all, you know, etched in and finished.
Yeah. What, are you a fight fan yourself or no? Or are you just more of a fight
yeah,
fan?
I've always been watching UFC since the beginning. Gracies were, yeah, choking everybody out.
So I want to get into that a little bit. What do you, I know you probably watched the recent, Francis Ngannou fight. What do you think about John Jones versus Francis Ngannou? I mean, I know you got to say he's going to win cause he's your boy, but how do you feel about the fight in general?
Yeah, I feel great about it. I think John has so much experience and such a broader skill set. Obviously, you want to watch out for your opponent's strengths and expose their weaknesses. And I think it's a great matchup. I'm here to support John 100%. So obviously, I'm bullish on his prospect of winning any fight. When whoever the opponent may be, we would just try and identify their weaknesses and John's strengths and. But we're working on everything just so he has the capacity to do whatever he wants to do when he's in the ring. And I think that you know, most importantly, that you get him there healthy, that he's as fast and as strong and as cardiovascularly fit as possible so that he can execute whatever plan that he determines. He's got one of the greatest fight IQs in UFC history. So whatever he decides to do when he's in the ring, it's our responsibility to make sure that he has the capacity to do that.
Yeah. So he said in a recent interview that he wants to be as big or bigger than Francis Ngannou. And I know that's, you know, it could be just something you say in an interview, but you're with him every day and he does have another 4 to 6 months. How much muscle do you think you can put on him? Like what weight do you think you can actually get him to on like not on stage, but in the ring?
You know, I've had this discussion with John. He would like to be as big and strong as possible. You talk to fight people who are in the fight game behind the scenes. Really smart folks that deal with fighters on a daily basis, they think a 220-pound John Jones could beat Francis Ngannou or any heavyweight just because of his skill level.
Yeah.
As long as he's, you know, as long as he's healthy there and strong and fast. And I tend to believe the same. You know, he's 254 right now.
Okay.
My deal with John, because you and I are, you know, we're in the world of muscle. And, you know, we know how to add muscle. We know how long it takes to add, you know, good, lean, usable muscle. My deal with John is really one of performance. If John's endurance, strength, explosiveness, speed can maintain or improve, then I'm not too concerned about his body weight.
Okay.
You know, if his broad jump or his high jump or his cardiovascular fitness. We do tempo runs. We do overspeed treadmill. So we're able to measure all of this. If any of that gets compromised by his weight, then, you know, at that point, we'll have a discussion as to whether or not that weight is a benefit. Okay. But as long as it's not a detriment, I'm not too concerned. I do think he'll be, every time we get him all etched out, I know he wants to be as heavy as possible. Realistically, I'm thinking, you know, I just had a discussion with him the other day that he's, you know, he could be in the high 240s and be fit and lean, looking at him now and knowing his body composition. So that would be a nice goal. And it would, I think as long as it translated into improve performance, then I'm happy with that. But I'm not focused on the scale first. Obviously, I'm focusing on what do his tempo runs look like? What's his speed look like? Yeah. What's his, you know, cardiovascular fitness? What's his strength? What's his explosiveness? We measure all of that in terms of performance first.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm really interested to see is, now that you've mentioned it, because I wasn't thinking about this before, but I wonder how run down he was in his previous fights. And I wonder how fresh he's going to be in this fight and what the difference will be. Because I can only imagine if he was run down in his previous fights, he's only going to be even more incredible come fight time.
Yeah, some of John's camps, by his own admission, he would get into camp maybe 10 weeks before a fight, which you and I would be like, wow, that's it's not very long.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's extremely talented, has a long history of fighting, and so he would get into shape pretty quickly. But my concern was that, as previously mentioned, that when you're dieting during training camp, it's really hard to recover from that intensity of training. You're certainly not going to add any muscle or strength, maybe strength.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, it's just much more difficult to train with the same level of intensity in a calorie deficit as it is in a slight surplus.
Yeah.
And so now we've got a unique opportunity with over 4 months at a minimum before a potential fight to train him in a slight surplus. And so his energy levels are good. He's getting stronger every workout, faster. He feels great. He's, you know, mentally he's fresh.
Yeah.
And his sparring sessions are going fantastic. His wrestling, jiu-jitsu and pads. He's just starting to dominate already after only, you know, less than a month of being back in there.
So you're the one who plans his week out. Like, you're going to strike this much. You're going to strength and conditioning this much. You're going to do this. Are you the one who does all that?
Yeah. Well, I'm the one who coordinates that with his coaches.
Okay. Okay.
So they say what they need. And then I just make sure that they're getting enough of his time and that I know what level of intensity that they're engaging in so that I can manage his recovery. And then we kind of coordinated all that together. So
which coach needs the most? That's what I want to know. I want to know which coach comes to you the most and says, I need him the most of all.
They all want him the most.
They do, right?
But fortunately, he's been lifting. You've seen a lot of videos of him lifting, and he's strong on a lot of lifts. There are some lifts that he did not enjoy as much as others, and so he's not as strong on those. And so we're kind of focusing on those now. But
sure.
He doesn't really need as much lifting for strength per se. But for speed strength, we have implemented some things that are new. Mm-hmm. I brought out Matt Wiedemer from Beat Personal Training in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay.
Matt was a strength and conditioning coach at University of Pittsburgh under Buddy Morris, and then was a strength and conditioning coach at Cleveland Browns, again under Buddy Morris, who's now the strength and conditioning coach for the Atlanta Arizona Cardinals.
Okay.
And Matt spent probably the last 20 years his own facilities in Cincinnati. He was a strength and conditioning or he actually worked with Louis Simmons at his gym and competed in powerlifting for nearly 20 years. At Westside Barbell. So he's very experienced, but one of the things that he's particularly talented with is speed. He's worked with a lot of track athletes and NFL football players over the years. And he's implemented an overspeed treadmill program at his gym for, I think it's been at least 12 plus years.
Yeah.
And so we purchased and had a overspeed treadmill delivered here. And John's been running on it. You've seen some videos possibly of him on Instagram.
I'm sorry, Stan, I don't mean to interrupt, but can I ask, what is an overspeed treadmill?
An overspeed treadmill will actually go up to, say, 25 plus miles an hour.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And it allows you to kind of like almost as if you, some people will run downhill thinking they could, you know, create more speed. A lot of problems with that, of course, you know, your stride length, and it's not sport specific. You know, when I was doing training track athletes at the University of Oregon, back then they were doing things like running in the sand or using parachutes or using ladder drills. none of which seem to be terribly effective. They also can interfere with the motor patterns for, you know, a proper stride. But the overspeed treadmill does seem to translate to increased speed on the track. Also, you know, it increases just metabolically, it increases speed overall.
Okay.
And so we can use a slight, it's not much different than bodybuilding, adding, you know, 2.5 pounds or one rep here or there. We can measure it. We can progress it over time. And it just allows us to implement a tool. A lot of people will also try and run uphills. That shortens your stride length. It, you know, you're generally bent forward, so you don't have hip extension, which you need in obviously in fighting. And so we don't think that's the best pattern. Also, in terms of building cardiovascular fitness, we'll use tempo runs on that treadmill, and we can time. Usually, we're in the alactic anaerobic area under 10 seconds or at 10 seconds. And then we'll just do intervals there. We'll just do tempo runs. We'll sprint for 10 seconds, then we'll rest for a minute, sprint for 10 seconds. Over time, we can increase that, the speed of that sprint, and we can decrease the duration of the rest. And so that more and more replicates fight, which is, you know, it's a very aggressive, explosive, you know, kind of like football, a 6 second full explosion, the 30 second rest. Fighting is explosive with brief rest, It's not, you know, road work doesn't actually replicate that. So we are trying to build a big cardio base, but we're using the tempo runs in that first 10 seconds, what we call the alactic anaerobic energy system, to build that over time. And so far he's been progressing very, very well, but it's just a tool that we use that we didn't have previously that we think is superior to some of the other options he may have used in the past.
I want to stick with training for one more question. I just want to ask, how often is he weight training? Like, how often is he doing traditional weightlifting, or even some, I've seen you doing some of the strength stuff that you do with, or not strength, but I don't even know what you would call it. The, you know, pulling the sleds or the wheelbarrows and stuff like that. How often is he doing that kind of stuff every week?
Yeah. Some of that would probably be considered recovery. The sleds and the wheelbarrows, they just don't create a lot of systemic fatigue. They allow him to, you know, get a lot of blood and move a lot. Some of those are designed for things like sustained contraction or, you know, just the gripping and holding exercises, which is great for, you know, the Greco-Roman base for wrestling, and that obviously would translate to fighting, but it doesn't cause a lot of fatigue, actually can help you recover from previous workouts and prepare for the next. So currently we'll do two upper body and two lower body sessions a week. And the one will be a heavier and one will be lighter. Both will be generally focused on still being explosive. We want the speed of the reps. We don't like grinders necessarily, although we will go up to a reasonably heavy single, maybe repeat that a couple times, just to, you know, to maintain and to hopefully improve strength over time without, you know, draining someone like a power lifter would do.
I want to actually touch on this before I move away from training, and it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be related to fighting, because I think even like people like myself and people watching that are older could utilize this, or even younger. But you said those workouts are actually done to help recover. And I think that's, I think that statement's confusing to a lot of people, including myself. I'm not going to pretend I know what that means, but most people wouldn't look at a training technique as in helping me recover, right? The recover usually means rest, don't do anything. So can you explain how those movements are actually aiding in recovery?
Yeah, well, first of all, they're not heavy enough to cause a significant amount of damage.
Okay.
Secondly, they're mostly concentric. So like dragging sleds doesn't have the eccentric phase. So there's less muscle damage.
Okay.
And thirdly, we don't load the lumbar. And so that creates less central nervous system fatigue. And then there's a lot of movement. So you're getting a lot of blood flow. We'll, marching with sleds in particular, you use tons of blood. You'll feel a fantastic pump. I've spoken before about how when I was training with Mark Bell in 2009, and I would do a heavy squat day on Sundays, I usually lay around for 2 days, just sit and sleep. And I would have an enormous amount of delayed onset muscle soreness. So I'd be fatigued and tired all the time.
Yeah.
And so I got a recumbent bike and I put it in my hotel room where I was staying in Sacramento while training with Mark. And after a big squat session on Sunday, that evening, I would do a little HIIT session. I would do 10 minutes on the bike against modest tension, you know, 40, 50 seconds at a decent pace under modest tension, 10, 15 second rest. I would repeat it 10 times. And then the next day I would do that 3 times. I would do it, you know, after breakfast, after lunch, and after dinner. And I found that my recovery was accelerated, my delayed onset muscle soreness. And we see that in the research now too, that movement is superior to passive therapy.
I see.
Okay. Things like massage, electric stem, cryotherapy, all of those things are inferior to actual movement. And the frequency of the movement is important, and hence my always promoting the 10-minute walks. In addition to digestion and blood sugar management, just the frequency of doing that 3 times a day. I always just say that, a body in motion tends to stay in motion. A motion is the lotion. At my age, I'm like the tin man without an oil can, and that's my oil. And so I move a lot every day.
Yeah, it sounds so counterintuitive to everything we've been taught as bodybuilders, because, people say, oh, take that rest day, don't move, lay on the couch, watch TV. Hey,
I lived it, man.
Yeah,
I was the skinny kid. Don't run if you can walk, don't stand if you can sit, and don't stay awake if you can sleep.
No, but it's true.
Full of food everywhere I went.
But you know what's funny is, I know you're right, because one of the things I tell clients is, and this is, I just never really formulated the thought all the way through, but one of the things I tell clients is after a heavy leg day, get on the treadmill the next morning. That, because some people say, well, should I avoid the treadmill after legs? Because, my legs are sore, it's going to break down muscle. And I'm like, no, it'll actually help you get through the soreness faster. And now that you're saying it, even more of a micro pattern where you're doing 10 minutes. So basically what you're saying is, the more blood flow we can promote with the least amount of effort, I guess, is what we want to do.
Yeah. It's kind of why I like sprinting stairs. It's mostly concentric. It's push, push, push. You don't get that. But if you sprint out on a track, you get that decelerating force where the as you start to slow down and your foot strike is actually decelerating your body.
Yeah.
There's a lot of impact. People get injured sprinting. They don't realize how dynamic it is.
Yeah.
And so I try and pick concentric, mostly exercises that you can do and pumping a lot of blood into the muscles. You feel completely regenerated the next day. The workout itself, your heart rate will go up and you'll feel the pump in your legs from marching with a sled dragging behind you. Yeah. And you can do it a number of different ways. You could do a quad drive, or you could take big steps and use mostly a hamstring and glute drive. So there's variations to it, but we've mostly from Matt's experience and from that of working with all those football players and in my experience having utilized it, it's even better than pushing a prowler because you do have some stacking involved with that. That can be a little fatiguing.
Let me ask you this. So I know for health purposes, and this is probably going to be a silly question after I ask it, just because I can think it through already, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So the question I want to ask is, and I know it's healthier to do what you're saying, and I know it is better for mobility as we get older, but in bodybuilding terms, is it better for a bodybuilder to rest and not move? If we're not talking, let's say he's completely healthy, his joints are fine, everything's fine. I'm talking to the 25-year-old out there that like is trying to just put on the maximum amount of muscle. Should he use his rest day as a sit on the couch, sleep, do as much rest as possible, or should he use his rest day as, get 2 or 3 small sessions of something in?
I'd get 2 or 3 small sessions in. I think it's better for getting glucose into the muscles because, as you know, the muscles will uptake glucose from the bloodstream in the absence of the need of insulin simply from movement. It helps you recover faster. So now potentially you can increase the total amount of volume that you do because you've got a larger cardiovascular base. Mm-hmm. You're recovering from workouts faster. And so I would suggest the movement. Obviously, the caveat is you still need to maintain a calorie surplus, but 3 10-minute sessions of just moving, whether it's a walk or a recumbent bike. I like recumbent bike for bodybuilders because you do pump more blood into the knees. It's more recuperative. This seems to be, one of the things is repetitive strain on the knees. So that really helps with the joints, the tendons and ligaments. There's not much blood flowing into tendons and ligaments. They're not innervated with capillaries the way the muscles are. So muscles recover very fast. The joints is usually through a pressure gradient. But when you move, it's much more effective. That's how the joints actually absorb, get blood and absorb nutrients and filter out, through the lymphatic system, all of the toxin, all of the accumulated waste from training. So to me, it's more than just recuperative. It's also about building and growing. So I would definitely do something. More recently, I've been utilizing the ATP walks, the marches, where I get on a belt squat of any kind.
Yeah.
And I put a belt around my hips and I just walk back and forth. Pumps a ton of blood into my hips and glutes. And, historically I have had some problems with my hips, but I don't even notice it anymore. They feel fantastic.
I think I saw that. I think somebody posted recently, John Meadows had them grab a cable from between their legs.
Yeah.
And pull it forward and then just march back and forth for 20 reps or something like that before actually doing the movement they were going to do.
Yeah. It just really helps put a lot of blood into the hip joint. You get a similar benefit from using a hip circle, going side to side and forward and back. It's just a lot of what you do, in bodybuilding, powerlifting, and sports in general is involves the hips and the hip flexors and the glutes. And so it's just a way to pump blood in there. The bike, I think, does a good job of that as well, but you feel a whole nother level of blood flowing into those hips when you do those marches. It's another way to keep the thing interesting too and fun. And so I use a variety of different methods.
It's interesting to me because, for me personally at 42, the common theme is always don't move and get a lot of massage done and all these kind of things. And now you're telling me just to do more, but less, you know what I mean? Instead of sitting around. So that's actually a really interesting point. I know there's a lot of older guys out here that watch the show. What can they do to keep their body intact other than these recovery methods? Like when they're training, should they scale back on their training from, 5 or 6 days a week, the way traditionally bodybuilding does it, to 4 or 3, or how do you suggest somebody can keep their body, keep their muscle and keep growing and keep healthy?
Just like with John and setting up a schedule with his coaches, it really has to do with managing fatigue and selecting the kind of exercises that build mountains instead of dig ditches. So a lot of the stuff we just discussed, as a power lifter, I've always focused on heavy, basic multi-joint movements. The problem with that is as you age is that it creates more and more fatigue. You wake up the next morning, you're just exhausted and things hurt and you can't train with the same frequency. You don't recover as well. And so I had to be more selective about the exercises. More recently, you see me doing leg presses. My feet are very close and very narrow and very low. And I'm just focused on stretching the quad. Yeah. And I can use about half the weight because I'm not involving my glutes and hips.
Sure.
Well, most powerlifters and bodybuilders or people who have trained for long enough as they get into their 40s and 50s, they have enough ass. Okay. We've loaded a lot of weight on our backs. And we got enough ass.
Definitely.
Yes. And we really don't need to train that. I also find that in leg press, we'll try and put ourselves in the most advantageous position to lift as much weight as possible. Yep. That doesn't necessarily mean that the quads are getting the best workout.
Yeah.
So we'll get a high and wide stance that loads our glutes. We'll push our stomach into our thighs. None of that really helps isolate or build quadriceps. You know, Dorian said he got away from squats very early in his career because he was strong such that he was just injuring his knees and not really building his quads. He was just getting ass and hips. So I don't squat as much or as with as much volume. I'll do it less frequently, maybe less heavy. I use a technique that allows me to, you know, even like a Smith machine squat, where you get more range of motion at your knees as opposed to focusing on glutes and hips. The weight goes way down. I also, by shortening the rest periods, maybe the first set, you did 10 reps, but you could have done 20.
Yeah.
But after a 90-second rest, the second set, you know, you do 10 reps, you probably only could have gotten 14. But by the third set, you did 10, and that was probably pretty damn near failure just because you shortened the rest period to 90 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's more metabolic than it is joint, you know, and central nervous system loading. Yeah. And I think that's preferable. And then I also, the belt squat to me is a huge advantage. If you can get, you know, any belt squat where you're loading below the lumbar, you just recover from that faster. I wake up the next morning and my muscles are sore, but my joints aren't. That to me is a big indicator that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And so I do all of those things. And I really, generally speaking, don't lift anything I can't lift for at least 8 or 10 reps anymore.
I think it wouldn't be a good podcast if I don't go back to John for 1 second. There's two things I want to cover still, and I don't want to keep you too long because it's almost been an hour, but, when we were talking about John, we were talking about diet, but I didn't actually get into a sample. Like, I just, I'm curious what he's eating, like calorie wise, or what's one meal look like. I know you have the vertical diet, so I don't understand a lot of it's red meat, but how many calories is somebody like John taking in right now? And what kind of surplus is he under?
Try and keep him at about a 500 calorie surplus. His workload is high, so he's north of 4,000 calories a day.
Okay.
250 grams of protein at a minimum, divided into four meals. So he's about 60 plus grams of protein per meal.
Okay.
The fundamentals of that are primarily he'll eat 5 or 6 ounces of lean top sirloin steak with a meal. Maybe a scrambled egg. You know, I'm obviously a big fan of the micronutrients in eggs.
Yeah.
And then some yogurt, usually maybe a yogurt OJ shake. So it's easier to consume more of it just as a vehicle, mainly for calcium, but there's also good protein in there. And that would be a fat-free only because there's adequate fats in the meats and the eggs. Try and keep the fats down. So I said it was a gram of protein per pound of body weight or thereabout, 250 plus. Keep the fats at about 0.4 grams per pound. So we're trying to stay somewhere around, you know, probably closer to 80 right now. It's a little higher just because it's hard to I don't want to over restrict. I want to keep the eggs and the red meat in there. So about 70 grams protein or 70 grams of fats per day, 70 to 80. And then the rest is carbs, and those might adjust because we do the pre and post workout drinks. He'll have a carb sodium blend. I should mention that that's a very specific prescription as well, as you know, John Meadows has talked about a lot, and I've talked about a lot over the years. You don't sweat out just water; you sweat out water. You know, and you burn carbohydrates, and you sweat out sodium and some magnesium as well.
Sure,
and so. You know, we replenish him when he drinks. He doesn't drink just water. He drinks water, sugar, and salt. And for a hard training, 2-a-day athlete, that's absolutely necessary. Some people might even weigh before and after training to make sure they're getting adequate water or adequate fluids. So we're using a product currently called Levelin, and it's from Dr. Sandra Godick's group out of the Heat Institute. I reached out to her folks again to get a sweat test for John. Like I did with Ben Smith, the CrossFit national champion, with Brian Shaw, we got him a sweat test to find out how much salt they're sweating an hour. So we can, you know, accurately provide them replacement for that. Mm-hmm. And so they have a product called Levelin, at the Heat Institute. And that it's about 50 grams of carbs with about, I think it's 700 milligrams of sodium. that you just blend with 16 ounces of water, and we'll drink that, you know, 30 minutes prior to training and immediately after training, and then sip on it throughout. And that's kind of the, you know, hydration becomes a big piece. John sweats a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the absence of that, you can start getting headaches and fatigue and decline in performance, and your stamina and endurance starts to suffer. Nothing new that I haven't spoken about before, but we're really diligent about it. I bring them to the gym in case that, you know, he doesn't have everything he needs all the time.
Yeah. I was trying to look up that supplement. Do you know?
It's L-E-V-E-L-E-N. L-E-V-E-L-E-N. And Dr. Sandra Godick's a PhD in thermoregulation and hydration, one of the foremost authorities in the world on that. And her people have been very good about working with me over the years. They do all the sweat testing for the Philadelphia Eagles.
What did you say the heat in? Oh, wait, here it is. L-E-V-E-L-E-N.
L-E-V-E-L-E-N. Yeah, the Heat Institute.
The Heat Institute. Okay.
Yeah. 1 second. It's a fantastic product. It's different than most because it does not include potassium for a very specific reason. When you work out, your muscles excrete potassium into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And so it's really not necessary to add potassium to a post-workout drink. Also, supplemental potassium tends to be hard on digestion with the lining of the stomach. So it's somewhat unique in that regard. A lot of people will drink Pedialyte, but it has 1,000 milligrams of potassium in it for every 1,000 milligrams of sodium. It's a 1-to-1 ratio. Ideally, you'd maintain a 4-to-1 ratio. And there's, I don't believe there's any sugar in Pedialyte, and you do want some carbohydrate, because obviously you're utilizing that during training, but it also helps absorb the sodium better if you have a carbohydrate in there.
When you said 4-to-1, that's 4-to-1 potassium, right? Four
potassium. No, sodium to potassium. 4 sodium, 1 potassium.
Okay. Okay.
For a rehydration
drink. I gotta check our products. I'm pretty sure we have an electrolyte blend in our intra. So what do you think about the intra drinks? This is actually, sorry, led me to something else. What do you think about some of the intra drinks that are on the market now? They don't carry enough of what? They don't carry enough potassium, enough sodium.
Well, I love the idea of having an intra drink or a pre-intra and post. It should include some carbohydrates, some simple carbs, and it should include some sodium primarily.
Okay.
And magnesium is a nice addition, but you know, again, you can supplement that at any time of day. It doesn't need to be around the workout, but I would just say water, salt, and a little bit of sugar.
Okay.
The percentages, you know, become secondary, really. Okay. I don't want to be too particular, but okay. It's far better than water. Water can actually dehydrate you, as you know, to dilute your electrolytes. So
sure.
For a hard training individual, then you definitely want that. And we're talking about athletes, you know, if you're sedentary, obviously hypertensive. Okay. And I feel bad even having to say this, but there's always academics out there misrepresenting my recommendations, Stan's telling everybody to eat salt.
Yeah.
We don't eat fast food. We don't eat packaged food. So we need to add sodium to our meals for that reason. And we're training hard and sweating. So we utilize sodium. These are recommendations that are consistent with the International Society of Sports Nutrition. Dr. Andy Galpin does a great 2-hour presentation on hydration replacement. And it's all really consistent with that advice.
Okay. Moving on to a couple of one other thing, actually, I want to ask you before you go. I know I don't want to keep you too much longer. I just want to ask you about gear. Do you mind talking about steroids a little bit?
Sure, no problem.
So I'm mainly concerned with steroids over 40 because I get a lot of guys messaging me. Like I said, there's a lot of older guys that watch this show, and they're curious. Do they have to take less? What are some good compounds? Like, is there some general rules you can give me for guys over 40 that are still interested in being enhanced?
I get this a lot because a lot of guys over 40 start to experience more side effects than benefits.
Yeah.
They're right. Taking too much of stuff that they shouldn't be taking. High blood pressure, maybe some compromised kidney function with EGFR, liver, AST, ALT. Yeah. Elevation and just generally feeling like shit. Some of it is you know, water retention. Some of it's diet and sleep and nutrition, obviously, but the blood pressure is the big one.
Yeah.
And you want to take, usually the base should be testosterone. And you want to take about as little as necessary or as little as possible to give you the physiological benefit that you're looking for. And it's hard to judge that in terms of a number on a scale, because some people can have a testosterone of 400 and feel just as good as somebody with an 1100 testosterone. And there's really no evidence that the difference between the two results in any improved performance. We see equivalent outcomes with both testosterone levels. People always think that if they're at the lower end, that somehow they might be compromised. It's only if it's associated with additional symptoms, erectile dysfunction, lethargy, loss of strength or lean muscle tissue, increase in body fat. Some of that is usually more driven by poor habits, poor sleep, bad nutrition, too high of body fat.
Yeah.
As you know, that's, the aromatase enzyme will increase as your fat increases, and then you'll be converting testosterone to estrogen at a greater rate.
Sure.
So obviously just getting in shape would do wonders for improving a lot of the symptoms. Taking more testosterone doesn't fix that problem.
I see.
So the foundation is get in shape and get more sleep. You're going to feel a lot better. But then if you do supplement, if you're hypogonadal, if you're, don't produce adequate testosterone and you are having some symptoms, then testosterone should be the base. And you kind of have to experiment and see, start with, maybe 100 milligrams a week, and then, 70 to 100 a week. I usually like to do it divided doses, at least two doses a week, because of the half-life. I don't like to see spikes and, peaks and valleys that might cause you to have, different responses throughout the week.
Sure.
And so twice a week seems to be sufficient for that. Some people who have a real high estrogen conversion problem might go down to smaller doses more frequently. Yeah. I've seen them able to maintain a better estrogen level doing that.
Okay.
Now, beyond that, if you're talking about performance enhancing drugs, and we were just talking about hormone replacement therapy there, then there are some things you should definitely avoid as you age. One is orals. Those are obviously going to cause more liver problems and high blood pressure. Another one's Tren, of course.
Stan, when you say orals, do you mean all orals? Like, are you talking even like Anavar, like even mild orals? Are you talking about D-ball and Anadrol? Like, what are we talking about? Everything?
Anavar would be more mild than others.
Yeah.
There is some good evidence that I think one of the studies showed 600 milligrams of testosterone a week in one group compared to 200 milligrams of testosterone with 25 milligrams of Anavar a day to have equivalent outcomes.
Oh, wow.
So it does seem that 1 + 1 = 3, that the combining things can give you a better benefit. Having said that, Anavar can still suppress HDL.
Okay.
And if you have problems with lipids, then HDL is something that you want to maintain in a healthy range. It doesn't benefit you to artificially elevate it with niacin, however. Mm-hmm. It's not the driver. Usually high LDL is the bigger concern, and we just reduce saturated fats and exercise more and increase your fiber intake and lower your body fat. And that tends to be remedied as well. And then blood sugars tend to contribute to high triglycerides. So, we manage all of those things very aggressively. Most of it is the hyperinsulinemia. People just have elevated insulin, which is rarely tested for. They test for fasted glucose.
Wow, there's so many more questions, Stan. So how do you reduce insulin in the body?
It's just hard
more,
to
more exercise.
It's hard to have these conversations because it's never any one thing. It's multifactorial. And so if someone comes to me and says, "Hey, I'm having poor health. What do you think about taking testosterone?" I immediately think of a dozen other things that are important to navigate first, or testosterone may be a part of that comprehensive therapy. And obviously, blood sugars is a big, blood pressure being the primary.
That's right.
Thing. I mean, that'll kill you now.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we fix that first. But blood pressure is elevated by high blood sugars or high insulin. And so we want to manage that. Fasted glucose and HA1C are lagging indicators. You can have high insulin for years before it shows in your blood sugar tests.
So 1 second. So you can have a good A1C level and still have high insulin levels in your body.
Yes.
Because my A1C is in, which is, I was told, is like the long-term, for those of you who don't know, is a long-term Basically,
like a 3 month average of your blood sugars.
Yeah. So, and that determines whether you're diabetic or pre-diabetic or whatever. Mine is in the normal range. So yeah. I've always felt like that's okay, right? But if you're telling me I can still have high insulin levels at the same time, now that that worries me. So how do I manage that?
Well, hyperinsulinemia is when you eat food and your blood sugars elevate, and then more insulin is released than might be necessary in a insulin sensitive individual. In order to get those blood sugars to shuttle into the, to get stored, whether it be, you know, muscular or fat. And it can happen acutely. You can have a huge spike of insulin, but usually it's measured by area under the curve. How high does insulin raise and how long does it stay elevated?
Yeah.
And you can get a fasted insulin test. You know, we get fasted glucose, a 12-hour fasted glucose test.
Yeah.
And as mentioned, that fasted glucose could be normal, but you could have hyperinsulinemia. You could have a high fasted insulin. So glucose seems normal, but behind the scenes, the work that your body's having to do to get that glucose normal is more than what is otherwise healthy in an insulin sensitive and a metabolically healthy individual. So get a fasted insulin test. That's one step. And that might tell you, and unfortunately the range is somewhere between, I think it's 4 and 24 or something for fasted insulin. Anything over 6 is in my mind, something that needs addressed. Triglycerides are also a good leading indicator, because if you have high insulin levels, if your insulin is spiking too high or stays elevated for too long to control your blood sugars, a lot of those blood sugars will be converted into triglycerides in the liver. And so you start to see elevated triglycerides as a leading indicator of insulin resistance.
Okay, so what is this? This is something I feel like might actually pertain to me. How do you reduce insulin in your body?
Well, there's a host of, I have a high blood sugar quick fix kit in the Vertical Diet, along with my high blood pressure quick fix kit.
Okay.
A lot of similar things. First and foremost, you can lose weight. That seems to be one of the big drivers. Sleep is another big one. Your body becomes insulin resistant with just a night or two of shortened sleep. My co-author, his master's thesis was on IGF-1 and insulin resistance, and it's sleep has a huge component for that. Obviously, exercise. I mentioned that the muscles will uptake glucose from the bloodstream without the need of insulin. And so the 10-minute walks post-meal are twice as effective as medication like metformin, the number one prescribed medication in the world for type 2 diabetes to prevent or reverse type 2 diabetes.
Sure.
Is metformin. The 10-minute walk after meal, what they call postprandial, will decrease the amount of insulin and the duration that insulin is elevated. Okay. Again, what we call the area under the curve.
Sure.
We've seen some, I've listened to some great diabetes educators and doctors talk about how they have type 1 diabetics on 12 units of insulin a day, which is extraordinarily low.
Yeah.
But what they'll do is shortly after a meal, they'll spend 15 minutes on a step meal, the Stepmaster.
Yeah.
So that would be an extreme, 15, 20 minutes on a Stairmaster after a meal. The idea there being is that now the muscles are absorbing the glucose and managing the glucose in the bloodstream. And so less insulin needs to be utilized.
Sure.
So that's another huge thing. Eating protein first seems to reduce blood sugar and insulin. Eating more protein, obviously.
You can't eat them. You can't eat them together.
No, you can. You eat more protein, and then you eat the protein first, and then you eat the carbohydrates after the protein. It's in the same meal.
Yeah,
it seems like such a little thing, but it has shown to be effective. Diabetes.
So if I'm eating my chicken and rice, I can't
eat your chicken first.
It's better to eat the chicken first, but it's so much
100%. Yeah,
it's so much harder. It's so much harder to eat chicken by itself, though.
but there is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's some good evidence that actually helps.
Yeah.
We'd say ameliorate or make better the the amount of insulin that's released and the duration of which it's elevated to get for your blood sugars. The glycemic index does not seem to be a great indicator. It's kind of individualistic. And when you eat, that index was made in isolation, eating carbohydrates in isolation.
Yeah, yeah.
When you eat them with fats and proteins, it dramatically changes the absorption rate.
Yeah.
But the glycemic load does matter, the amount of carbohydrates you eat in a given meal.
Yeah.
And then whether or not those carbohydrates are eaten around training. So I would like to put, you know, some carbohydrates in my meal before I train and then take in a lot of carbohydrates immediately after I train.
Yeah.
And you'll have less of a spike of insulin because your muscles will be utilizing those carbohydrates. So timing then is what basically that says, time them mostly around. Also, you tend to be more insulin sensitive in the morning, which there's a lot of good evidence now to suggest that you should eat like a king for breakfast, a prince for lunch, and a pauper for dinner. Okay. It also seems to be good for sleep, for chrononutrition, to help you sleep better at night with a smaller dinner and then a larger breakfast when you have more insulin sensitivity. You also have higher cortisol in the morning, so it would benefit you to get carbohydrates, you know, a decent amount of carbohydrates for breakfast. I prefer to skip dinner than skip breakfast if I'm going to intermittent fast, but I don't necessarily recommend intermittent fasting for athletes.
But I feel like it's hard for people to, like for me, for example, and some of my friends that I talk to about this, it's harder for people to fall asleep when they're hungry. So usually they're, you know, they eat more later on.
Do we mitigate that with more food or do we mitigate that with higher satiety foods, such as, you know, a small boiled potato, which is a high satiety food, along with oranges, very high satiety food, and a high protein meal, and then a salad. So what I recommend for a lot of my dieters is that after dinner, because the vast majority of snacking occurs later in the evening, which is another argument for sleeping longer, because if you're awake fewer hours, obviously you're going to have less opportunity to snack.
No, it's very
in addition to the ghrelin hormone being released and making you hungry from too little sleep. It's just the look at the clock. You know, if you're awake longer, you're going to have to get another meal in. But a post-dinner salad is a great idea. And I have a salad in my vertical diet that's really easy to digest. It's low calorie. I like the iceberg lettuce because I don't enjoy chewing on spinach. It tastes like dirt and its texture is not enjoyable.
Yeah,
so I'll get like a romaine from Costco that's crunchy and I'll have that with, I might get some fat-free cheddar cheese. Kraft has one that Walmart sells. I'll certainly put in a little bit of strawberries. Fruits are very satiating. And you know, you can get a pound of strawberries for had less than 130 calories. Yeah, you're only going to eat two or three strawberries, but I'll put in maybe a couple of egg whites for texture. I'll add some shaved carrot, maybe a little bit of cucumber, and then I'll just put a little bit of apple cider vinegar on there, mostly for taste. I don't think there's anything magic about apple cider vinegar and blood sugars. It's been, you know, talked about a lot, but it's minimal and it's real result. But anyhow, that salad might take you 20 minutes to eat. You ever tried to chew and crunch on a salad like that?
Yeah.
So, you know, the satiety benefit of just the duration of chewing, the bulk in the stomach, the stretching of the wall, of course, sends the signal for satiety. And then the length of time it takes to digest, you get to bed and you don't have the same hunger. So the post-dinner salad, to me, eat your protein, have your little bit of carbs, ideally a boiled potato because it's satiating, then eat that salad. It's just a strategy that I utilize to keep people from getting hungry and overeating.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. So I just want to go back to steroids for a minute.
Yep.
When we were talking about performance enhancers, the first thing you said was avoid orals. And then we were going to go into one other thing. What's after that? You said avoid tren also. And then after that.
Yeah. Most of the, I'll just say straight out that when guys get over 40, particularly over 50, I'd like them just to stick with a smaller dose of testosterone and be patient and manage a host of other shortcomings in their program. Testosterone is not the driver of results. I think that people overemphasize its value. It's not a panacea. Certainly necessary to replace it if you're low. But I've maintained my testosterone somewhere in the 7 to 1100 range most of the last 5 years. And if I get squirrely and I want to do something extra special and add something to it, then I'm adding Primabol. Very safe. It's not going to, you know, you're not going to get massive results in a short period of time, but I found that if you run it for a few months, you do get, you do retain your lean body mass. You do get harder. You definitely helps you with your conditioning. Primabol is very effective at that.
Yeah.
I don't like the idea of gaining water at that age on anything else, DECA. Although I must say that we have seen good results with maybe 50 milligrams a week of DECA for people who have joint problems.
Okay.
And I don't know that I can point to a mechanism of action. I don't know that it's water in the joints. I don't have any evidence of that, but we just see it anecdotally, having dealt with hundreds and hundreds of clients and working with practitioners in the HRT field. Those with a lot of experience do see a little bit of benefit there, but by the same token, the other methods that I've suggested for joints, getting away from some of those major movements, and utilizing the bike or the ATP walks or the sleds, have really been, the driver of my joint health over the years too. So, sure. I just hate when people, I always say that things that are done to you or for you are never as effective as things you do for yourself. Sure. And that's back to the conversation about passive therapies versus actual movement. And I say the same thing about the DECA. Are you using it as a crutch for a poor nutrition, sleep, or movement habits? And can you fix that somewhere else? But I got to say, if it's performance enhancing over 40 or 50, if that's your choice, a little bit of testosterone, dosed at least twice weekly, just to get your numbers, your free testosterone, slightly elevated. I don't recommend anti-estrogens. I think they're bad for the joints. I think that they're bad for endothelial function to have suppressed estrogen. They're bad for libido. Okay. There's a whole host of things that estrogen is important for. If you're converting estrogen at a very high rate and it's elevated, generally, it's because you're over fat or you're taking too much testosterone or you're hypersensitive. I have seen some people on small amounts of testosterone that do convert it to a greater rate. But it's the exception, not the rule. Yeah. And then if they overuse anti-estrogens, then they end up, crashing their libido and otherwise, I think, compromising their health. I'll throw one other thing in, as I see of a lot of men over 50, particularly ones who have used testosterone over the years. Because it does convert to DHT, which can have an effect on BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia. And men start to get a problem with evacuation. They'll have their stream won't be as strong, or they'll not be able to completely evacuate. They'll have a sense of urgency. They'll wake up in the middle of the night multiple times.
Yeah.
A low dose tadalafil, 5 milligrams a day, tends to...
Cialis.
Now tadalafil does seem to help with reducing those symptoms of BPH. It also helps with increases nitric oxide, so it helps with blood pressure by dilating the vessels, and it helps with endothelial lining. It does help improve the lining of the blood vessels. So that is a therapy that I often recommend that people talk to their doctors about. And see if they can get to include that for those reasons.
Last question on the steroid front. GH is a peptide, not a steroid, but is GH is something you would suggest or not for people over 40?
I'm not a fan if they have any insulin resistance, because it can increase insulin resistance.
Okay.
And so if they do have high blood sugars or high insulin, you could, again, triglycerides is an obvious indicator of high blood sugars. Fasted insulin is an indicator, but they may have to go in and get an oral glucose tolerance test, OGTT, with insulin. You go in and your doctor feeds you some sugar water, And then he tests your glucose at 30, 60, 90, and 120 minutes to see how you respond, you're spiking. I'd have the insulin tested as well, which means you'll have four blood tests as well at 30, 60, 90, and 120. That would be a good indicator as to whether or not you're at risk from taking growth hormone. I would not want to take growth hormone if I had insulin resistance, because it can also cause insulin resistance.
I see.
And it's dose dependent. You know, maybe one IU before bed probably won't cause problems and might help you with your sleep and can improve your skin and might help with joints. But I don't think it's a panacea. I've fared quite well without it. I don't have any joint problems, and my sleep's fine. And I haven't had to utilize it. I used it historically, and I did notice that I experienced insulin resistance. My doses were higher, 4 to 6 IUs at the time.
Yeah.
I don't currently use it. I'm not, you know, I could, but and I do recommend it to some people. I'll tell you this, it's fantastic for women's skin. And that's not news. I think it was, what was her name from Three's Company that's always out? Suzanne Summers.
Summers, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, she's talked about it religiously on talk shows. And I have seen both with clients that have that I've spoken with personally and in the HRT world, that it really is helpful for women's skin.
Yeah, wow.
Has a huge impact. So, and again, work with your doctor and a qualified professional. And don't say Stan told me to take GH or test or Primobolan. And I do everything with blood tests. I've gotten my blood test almost on a monthly basis for 10 years, as I've mentioned. That it's a lot easier because I've maintained everything kind of the way I have over the last few years, that I don't necessarily need to do it. So I do it less often, maybe every 60 or 90 days.
Yeah. I had a kid in the gym just the other day, pull me aside and say, "Hey, my, liver enzymes, I think it was ALT, was at 182. And I said, "Well, I think it's time to go off. Like, you should probably take a break." Right.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring it up is, look, I know there's people of all ages watching the show, whether I have kids as young as 16 and men as old as 67 that have messaged me. So, anybody out there listening, if you have issues with your blood work, Stan, is there somewhere, can you help these people? Is there somewhere they can reach out to you for help?
Yeah, just go to stanefferding.com. I have instructions on there where you can get a blood test using private MD labs. You just go down to you buy the blood test. They email you a form that you print out. You go down to Quest and get your blood drawn. And 3 days later, they send you your results.
Oh, so you don't have to go to a doctor or anything. You just can download.
No, sheet. And you should have a medical professional review them. I do.
Yeah.
You know, I can only tell people, and from my experience in my vertical diet ebook, I have a list of the common tests, what they say and how to improve those markers if necessary. You know, I wanted people to be self-diagnosing, but certainly from personal experience, when I deal with my clients, I tell them, as we discussed today, as is in the high blood pressure and high blood sugar quick fix kit. And I discuss with them ways to improve all of those markers. I think it's important. I think people would find that there's a lot of other things they could do to improve their performance other than take more performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah. That's usually the recipe.
yeah.
No, the reason I said that about the blood test is a lot of people will message me and say, "I want to get blood work done, but my doctor won't help me. My doctor doesn't know why I want to get it done. He won't give me a requisition for it," whatever the dumb reason. So I think it's really interesting that they can just download it from your, or buy it on your website and get it done.
There's many companies that do it. PrivateMDLabs.com is the one I use.
Okay.
I have the instructions on my website for free. You don't have to go buy my ebook to get the instructions. They're in my store. Actually, I think I've got a box you just click on that says blood test that walks you through it. You get a 15% discount if you use Rhino as the discount code, but you got to go through my site to get it. I don't get paid anything for that. I just asked them for that when I put that information out. I thought it was important enough that people, particularly as you age, that you get a baseline.
Of course,
A very comprehensive test is around $300. It's not cheap, but there are some, the site offers a lot of less comprehensive tests that can still get your you know, your basic metabolic panel and your complete blood count and your lipids and your testosterone levels for, you know, in the low $125 or something like that. So yeah, there's other options available, but
Stan, is there anything new on the horizon you want to promote or talk about or say?
Yeah, everything's new. I tell you, it's just amazing. You too, on your end, I've watched your site just explode, your YouTube and your guests. I'm honored to be to be invited back here right after Dorian Yates. That was that's incredible.
Yeah.
But everything's new and exciting. I will say that the Vertical Diet book will be in bookstores in August. Pre-orders will be available next month, but a lot of people have asked about having a hard copy as opposed to just the online version. But and then I'm, you know, obviously still working on some projects. The Vertical Kids is my next project for you know, optimizing and you know, kids' performance and maximizing their genetic potential. But that'll be probably early next year before I can get that released, because I'm busy now, obviously.
Yeah. Can I ask you, does the Vertical Diet book come with recipes and everything for people so they can?
It does. Yeah. The ebook does. And the new Vertical Diet book will have recipes. And then we have a complete recipe guide. Mm-hmm. And then I have a Vertical Strength Training manual coming out shortly. But, you know, one that I'm really proud of that we've worked hard on, and I'm hesitant to promote it too aggressively because there's so many snake oil salesmen out there. Is our book, you know, people know that I built 5 multi-million dollar companies in the last 17 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of people ask me about business. And my, you know, from the time I was in college, I worked as a personal trainer. And I trained to put myself through college, and I was a high school soccer coach. And, you know, I owned a gym. I've been a trainer all my life. I still train people. And it's a passion of mine, has been all my life. It's hard to make a living in that industry.
Yeah.
Guys like us who, you know, have a resume and have maximized social media, we do fine. But the personal trainers on the front lines in the gyms, they struggle to make a career.
Yeah.
So I partnered again with Matt Whitmer from Beat Training. He runs very successful training centers, and his trainers make many of them make 6 figures. They make over $100,000 a year.
Wow.
Personal training, actual clients, paying them to do training sessions every day. They show up at the gym. So we wrote a book, a career book on how to become successful as a personal trainer. And it's on my website. And it's a step-by-step guide on very basic, just like the Vertical Diet, just the fundamentals, step-by-step on what things that you should do and need to do in order to have a career in that industry and be able to do just that. Because a lot of folks do it moonlight and have a hard time struggling to make a living at it. So I definitely recommend people take a look at that. And they're invited to come out to Cincinnati and shadow our trainers at Matt's gym. And see exactly what they do and how they are able to make a career at that.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, I know you have a extensive business background, so maybe part three, the third time you're on my show.
Yeah,
we'll just cover business, because actually that's probably the part I'm most interested in, is how you built so many different companies. But obviously we've been on way too long today. But the next time maybe you'll come on, we can just teach people how to get rich.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it. Yeah. And none of my marketing will be me standing next to an airplane or a Ferrari. It's just so cheesy. It's disgusting.
I dare you to do that. Just make one. Just for the hell of it. Just make one for the hell of it.
Yeah. No kidding.
Stan, look, man, I appreciate you coming on, man. It's always a pleasure and always very, very informational. So thank you very much. And good luck with John. I'm not sure if we're going to talk again before he fights, but I hope he does amazing, and I hope you're a huge part of it.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
We will talk again soon.
Take care.
Okay, man. Thank you very much, Stan.